Jesus holds out an invitation to us from 2,000 years ago. He says something like, if you forgive someone's sins, so does God. If you hold out on them, though, so does God. I mean, this is really almost a dare, isn't it?
That's the Reverend Tom Brackett. I'm Peter Wallace. Join us for some conversation and a powerful message of faith today on Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thank you, Sherry. Today on Day One, we're honored to have with us the Reverend Tom Brackett, an Episcopal priest who serves as missioner for church planting, ministry redevelopment, and fresh expressions of church for the Episcopal Church Center, headquartered in New York City. Tom has been passionate about lively communities of faith for 28 years of ordained life, having led two new church plants and started several new ministries within existing parishes. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Glad to join you.
Your job title at the Episcopal Church Center is quite a mouthful. How would you describe the range of your responsibilities?
It is far-ranging in that because I work in one of the regional offices, I represent a lot of the staff out in the field. Whereas the staff may stay at 8:15, I'm always on the road and constantly representing the best gifts we have to offer.
And I understand you offer your ministry through three primary channels.
I do. It's remarkable what we do with technology today. Mm-hmm. So the first is I offer training and coaching video conference and teleconference calls six times each month available to the public. The second one is that I offer long-term consulting with diocesan leaders on diocesan-wide revitalization, system-wide change. And then the third one is in-person presenting and training on the diocesan and provincial level.
So what is the goal of your work? What are you trying to do in the parish levels, for instance?
What I hope will come down to the parish level from diocesan and provincial levels is a sense of reverence for that which is emerging in our midst. If you flip my business cards over, I've handwritten on the back that my real job description is strategic mischief maker. And what that means on a large scale is that sometimes we get set in really comfortable ways of doing things, and it keeps us from recognizing the new things that are emerging and keeps us from being sensitive to the leaders we don't even know we need yet. So a lot of my work is advocating for the leadership that is waiting in the wings for the moment when we recognize we need you.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we mentioned, the Episcopal Church is headquartered in New York City, and you're on the road a lot, but where is your office?
It is at the Diocesan Center in the Diocese of Western North Carolina, headquartered in Asheville, North Carolina.
And you had served in a parish there before.
I did, in West Asheville, and served at the bishop's request as a priest in charge.
So how do you spend most of your time fulfilling your calling to the church?
I really work on three areas. I'm not an expert. Instead, I connect innovative leaders to each other. Most of the time, people doing innovative work are not aware of how valuable their contribution is, and they're working in isolation. So I listen to the wisdom that emerges from ministry stories around the church, and I resource practitioners and educators.
So as you travel on behalf of the Episcopal Church, where do you see signs of hope for our mainline churches?
Well, Peter, I'm happy to say it seems like more and more of us are waking up.
Mm.
It's almost like all those years of praying Eucharistic Prayer C are finally bearing fruit. There's that very inspired line right in the middle of the prayer that asks God, open our eyes to see your hand at work in the world about us. Well, I think it's happening.
Well, can you give us some examples?
I think there's some amazing examples of synchronicity happening right now. People are starting to connect with a new sense of holy urgency about the future that's longing to emerge. Recently, I heard about a couple who sold their house, found matching funds from the diocese, and decided to move in the poorest neighborhood in their area. They're opening up a church and a community center just to be present to their community. There's the story of Holly Antolini, a wise pastor leading St. James Porter Square outside of Boston to redesign their buildings to include the surrounding community intentionally. Then there's Jimmy Bartz there in Santa Monica, California, who decides not to market fads, and instead he's training his members to bring the community in a really low-key but high-integrity way, a countercultural witness to the Santa Monica culture. And more musicians are coming out of the woodwork. These are folks who've historically operated in isolation, and they're now saying, it's time. We don't want to work alone when we can be working together.
Tom, in your sermon, you will reflect on the gospel lesson for today, a rather puzzling parable of Jesus from Luke chapter 16. Would you read it for us?
Then Jesus said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Give me an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes.' So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, "And how much do you owe?" He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, "Take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes."
This is one of those teachings of Jesus that makes me tense up a bit, either because I don't understand it or I don't exactly like what he's saying, or I'm not sure what he's saying. Am I the only one who feels that way, do you think?
I think we all struggle with this one. It's tough. I think the hard part is separating out those attempts at interpreting it from the original story.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the verses that follow, verses 10 through 13, Jesus talks about being faithful in little things and not serving two masters, God and wealth. They almost seem to have been tacked on to explain away what Jesus had been saying in these verses. What do you think?
I think our best scholars are pretty clear that that's exactly what it is, that later editors put words in Jesus' mouth as a way of adding a moral to the story. And it sounds moralizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't wait to hear your sermon. It's entitled, "Jesus, the Rogue Rabbi." Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
And if you'd like to listen to today's program with Tom Brackett again, read his sermon transcript, or watch our video conversation, please visit our website anytime at dayone.org.
Well, what an impossible reading to reflect on for today's broadcast. This has always been one of those tough passages for me. I mean, by now you are probably wondering, is Jesus praising unjust and sneaky financial dealings? Would he be inviting us to take our cue from the clever manipulations of the corporate rogues at Enron, for example? Padding their pockets in the moment they're about to lose their jobs? If I read it accurately, the story actually praises the wisdom of the children of the world, right? And yet, let me ask you, would you want this employee as your investment manager? Here's how the story breaks open for me. I think that the way it sounds to you depends on the character you inhabit in this power play. If you're the master, this is insane. Your profit and loss statement just took a severe hit. If you're the one forgiven of debt, you'll be telling your grandchildren about this turnaround moment for years to come. If you're the one who just forgave and kept your job, this is a really great story. You resisted the criticisms and the social norms. You took a huge gamble, and it paid off. You gained the admiration of your master and kept your job. Scholars have reassured me that we cannot imagine what the original quote looked like. Jesus probably picked up a story from the local headlines and used it to answer his critics, the ones who despised his generosity of spirit. So he offers this popular story to explain the absurd generosity of the ministry he was offering. What complicates the story are the three or four interpretations layered over the original. I find it helpful to remember what leads up to this story. Jesus had consistently provoked the growing rage of his peers by freely forgiving the sins of those who came to him. He also healed them. In fact, Matthew 9 recalls that his critics didn't mind the healings as much as they were angered by his daring to forgive sins. In an odd way, I think the story breaks open a new view of God's impulse to give the farm away. This story of the rogue manager is most likely a picture of Jesus and the way he totally mismanaged his role as a rabbi. You heard me right. He mismanaged the rabbinic responsibility to mediate God's justice and carefully mete out forgiveness only after appropriate evidence that forgiveness had been warranted and the law had been satisfied. I choose to believe that this manager's crazy and irresponsible behavior is a description of the outrageous divine generosity squandered on all of us. I also have no doubt that we would probably scandalize this Jesus today as a rogue. He would not have made it through the ordination process in most of our denominations. Jesus bypasses right belief and baptism, synagogue membership, and societal standing when he goes around forgiving and reconciling so recklessly. I mean, if you knew you could go find Jesus on the street and experience divine acceptance in flesh and blood, why would you want to go pay temple authorities to put you through the ceremonial ringer? I have a sense that one of today's primary criticisms of Jesus would be that he was offering cheap grace. I mean, he does heal 10 lepers without even inquiring as to the sin that must have made them lepers in the first place. And he forgives a woman caught in adultery without first asking her to certify that she would leave adultery behind. Jesus is just giving these benefits away. All he asks is that those forgiven take up their crosses and follow him. The worst part is that the gospel writer is inspired to record that this story has the stamp of divine sanction. So at this point in our time together, I'd like to get really practical with you. Let me try on some potential applications of this story and invite you to note your internal responses. Imagine with me a continuum of responses. Over on one end of the continuum, you have, okay, I'm ready to take that idea on unreservedly. On the other end, you have you lost your mind, bracket? I'll offer some propositions. You note the location of your responses on that spectrum, okay? I know this may sound crazy for a radio broadcast, but bear with me. So on one end, okay, let's try it. On the other end of the continuum, crazy idea, bracket. Ready? Here's the first one. What if the real objective of our churches is to train and nurture every follower of Jesus as rogue agents of God's radical and outrageous generosity? I mean, like going out on the streets and giving away forgiveness and membership and healing and salvation. John, the gospel writer, recalls Jesus as saying, "If you forgive the sins of any, they're forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." What if all the other concerns plaguing organized religion became secondary to this? There is a remarkable story that comes close to illustrating what this idea might look like. One of the most popular videos on YouTube has scored more than 50 million hits in 5 years. By the way, that's 19 hits a minute every day for 5 years running. Here's the story. In 2004, an Australian that goes by the name of Juan Mann showed up at a party severely depressed and lonely. He recalls how that a random hug from a total stranger that night made him, in his words, feel like a king. It was the greatest thing that had ever happened to him. After that experience, he makes a sign offering free hugs and holds it up as an invitation at his local mall. The movement starts ever so slowly and invites all kinds of resistance. But over the last 6 years, people in 17 countries have received free hugs as random acts of kindness, selfless acts offered as healing to total strangers. Hey, I want to ask you, isn't that our job? How is it that a depressed and lonely man without community has to remind us? We need to be out there on those streets offering those free hugs on behalf of the living God. I think that the Jesus of this parable came to convince us that God longs for us to be reconciled, set free, to forgive and love, and be made whole and love in return unabashedly. Okay, here's another proposition for us to try on. What if our way forward as mainline American churches is to give away the very gifts we've been guarding so carefully behind our church doors? I mean, for example, what if we advertised services of baptism for anyone that wanted to show up and be baptized? I know this is thin ice for many of us, but let's be daring. Come on out here with me. Baptism as a rite of initiation was established as prerequisite for insider status long after Jesus' ministry. It was probably precipitated by the need to differentiate between insiders and outsiders during several decades of fierce persecution. If we decide to hold on to baptism today, even though Jesus' practice never supported it, we need to judge the merits of this rite of initiation by its real-time impact on those we baptize. Does this ritual act really impart a sense of the radical love that Jesus shows in this story? I mean, does baptism mark the beginning of a relationship with a faith community that loves the newly baptized soul into a wholeness you can't get anywhere else? I know this may be too daring, maybe even threatening to some of you. So let's try on something a little tamer. Let's ask, how else might we freely offer the gifts of the church to the average person on the street? Most of the time we expect the stranger to show up on our chancel steps so we can show them Christian hospitality. In a surprise variation on this, Sarah Miles and Paul Fromberg of St. Gregory of Nyssa organized the members to stand in San Francisco's busy transit stations on Good Fridays, offering a smudge of ash and prayers for healing to people too busy to show up in church. They've taken ashes and oil and prayers and hugs and God's outrageous love to the streets 2 years in a row, and the response has been, at once, heartrending and so beautiful. So many have said words to the effect that, "Never before have we had the church come to us," or, "We couldn't make it to church, but you brought God to us." Hey, I want to ask you, isn't that our job? And isn't that what Jesus models for us in this crazy story? But let's get really daring here. Ready? What if we work to make communion available to everyone? I mean, everyone. This is a tough one, isn't it? At this point, I find it helpful to remember that just as franchises are built and maintained by holding out exclusive rights to the brand, religious establishments are tempted to claim a unique grasp on access to the divine. I know some of you want to remind me that I am, after all, an Episcopal priest. I too am a part of an ecclesiastical hierarchy that's tempted to act like a franchise as well. I mean, we say, you can offer the wine, but not the bread. You can come join us for the meal, but you can't actually eat anything. You can attend our services, but you have to pay your dues for voice and vote. No wonder Jesus' actions infuriated his peers. He was defying their constitutions and canons. You could even say that he had marked down the fee for divine forgiveness so much that it was affordable to everybody, and it was accessible. I think that's the key. So can you imagine what our world would be like if just a few of us started to freely forgive each other like this? So at this point in my time with you, let me ask you something. What did you feel as I named these potential applications of this crazy story? Did you feel the urge to set this straight and tame it down a little? With which of the characters do you more readily identify? Do you imagine your resistance to be much different than the response you would have had if the gospel story had been the story of your accounts receivable manager and the way she might write off half the money people owe you? Jesus holds out an invitation to us from 2,000 years ago. He says something like, "If you forgive someone's sins, so does God. If you hold out on them, though, so does God." I mean, this is really almost a dare, isn't it? In the barest form of this story, Jesus praises the manager for acting generously on the master's behalf. He holds this out and dares us. Go ahead, get lavish and give it away. Watch how shalom and chesed become you. Watch how my world is restored and all of creation is reconciled to my dream when you say yes to this story. May I offer you what helps me when I try on this dare? I close my eyes and I imagine the great cloud of witnesses that surround us, waiting with bated breath, hoping we'll say yes. All those who have gone ahead of me who now know that in this story is the key to a tomorrow I want to pass on to our human family. It's the key to a season of jubilee to which everyone has access. It's the dream of God, isn't it? And so I'm wondering, would you join me and say yes to God in this moment? Let us pray. O God, Mother of us all, birth in us a new courage to give away the best of what you offer us. Be patient with us as we learn how to empty ourselves of our fears and protectiveness. May we be a part of your dreams coming true, O lover of our souls. Breathe into us new life, new courage, new generosity, and even new daring, so that with every one of our breaths we can say yes to you. Into your hands we commend our spirits. Amen.
Today's message by the Reverend Tom Brackett is entitled, Jesus the Rogue Rabbi. Tom serves as missioner for church planting, ministry redevelopment, and fresh expressions of church for the Episcopal Church Center in New York City. For a free transcript of today's sermon, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1 or write Day 1, 644 West Peachtree Street, Suite 300, Atlanta, Georgia, 30308. Visit us online at dayone.org to listen again to today's program or watch video interviews with our preachers. And remember, Day 1 depends on the financial offerings of our faithful listeners. Thank you for your support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next week, we're delighted to welcome the Reverend Tom Warren, pastor of Pleasant Hill Community United Church of Christ in Pleasant Hill, Tennessee. His message is entitled, When Battered and Besieged, Buy. Be sure to be with us. Now, Tom Brackett offers some final thoughts on this week's message with our host, Peter Wallace.
Tom, I think you're onto something when you suggest that this parable is a description of God's outrageously lavish generosity to all of us. There isn't much narrative context for this story here in Luke chapter 16, but it does come right after the story of the prodigal son, which so beautifully reveals the father's prodigal love, prodigal in terms of being wasteful and lavish, for the prodigal son. What do you think of that connection?
Oh, I think you're right on. I love the NRSV translation of that word, squandered. Mm. What's it like to have a father that squanders love on you, even when you test the limits of acceptable behavior? I think you're right on.
But why do you think we react against God being so wasteful and lavish with his love?
Because it's indiscriminate. and how can I think of myself as better than anyone else if everyone receives that same squandered love?
You offered some very powerful applications for us to respond to. You asked us first to consider whether the real objective of our churches is to train and nurture every follower of Jesus as rogue agents of God's radical and outrageous generosity. What do you think that might look like in our churches?
I wonder that, too. It seems to me like we need to give a lot of energy and dream and visioning around that. But I, just off the top of my head, I can imagine every member dressing up as celebrants and specifically making it their goal to go out into the world during the week and see what evidence of the Spirit's work can I celebrate? And how do we do that publicly as a way of holding up evidence that God does squander his love, her love on all of us?
And you suggested we take our sacraments to the streets, mm-hmm. to everyone. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense to me, and it sort of sounds like the Great Commission of Christ to go into all the world. Why do you think we in the church tend to hold on to these divine gifts so closely in the first place?
I think the reason we do is probably not too far from the reason that I do, and that is I still believe in a zero-sum game. I'm still affected by a scarcity mentality that if I give it all away, there won't be anything left. And I think the whole story here is you can give it all away and there's still going to be much more than you're ever going to be able to receive. And once I believe that down into my core, it's also different. Mm. I have a sense that the church is waiting to be reinvented, that we feel as though historically our call has been to mete out God's generosity, as though it were our job to give it out. When in reality, God's generosity flows to the world, hopefully through us, but nonetheless always is flowing out to the world. So if we would redefine our role in the world and see that we're there to celebrate God's generosity towards all of humanity, all of creation, it would tip over our assumptions about who we are and how valuable we are in the world.
You said in the barest form of this story, Jesus praises the manager for acting generously on the master's behalf. He holds us out and dares us, go ahead, get lavish and give it away. How should we believers take Jesus up on that dare?
The sense I have is that not only is this a dare, but the future of the world depends on at least a few of us getting this. That the tide that needs to be turned has been overwhelming us. And we need prophetic voices in our midst that would open up to us new images of what God longs for in the world. So it's more than a dare, isn't it? It's like God has staked everything on us saying yes.
Tom Brackett, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. We're online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.
We consider Day One to be an important extension of the pulpits of the 30,000 churches our program represents each week. These churches are our partners. If your congregation would like to be a part of the Day One ministry, our new Partner Church program on the Day One website will give your congregation national visibility and an outreach to the thousands who visit our website every day. Remember, we rely on the support of our listeners and churches to stay on the air. We need your partnership in this important ministry. So to find out more about this new program, visit online at dayone.org or call and talk to one of our staff at 1-888-411-DAY-1. And thank you so much for your support.